Good morning. It's a commercial break from Batman, 1966. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. It is a fine day and good day all around. We'll try not to screw it up for you. And we have a great panel. I'll get to introducing them in just a moment. I do want to remind you that you can be a part of our program. It's very easy to do. All you have to do is write to us. It's panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. And we would love to hear from you on the many issues that we will discuss this morning. Now, not surprisingly, we're going to talk about the debt ceiling this morning, and we've been starting out with that very sexy topic, although we've been getting a lot of mail on it. People are very concerned about it, so we'll make our way through that again at the top this morning. Let me introduce everybody to you. Albany's Chief City Auditor Dorsey Appleers is here. Good morning, Dorsey. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing very well.
Really nice to have you here. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Good to see you. J.P. Miller, the Empire Report's very own, the man responsible for the Empire Report. J.P., good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I got a ride in from a guy named Sika this morning, and he had on the radio, he had WAMC on. And so I said, do you listen to WAMC? And he said, yeah. I said, well, I've got this sweatshirt on. I'm going to be on in WAMC, and I'm going to say hi to you, Sika. So, Sika, thank you for the ride.
That's so cool.
Really nice guy.
Were we hitchhiking? What were we doing?
No, not hitchhiking. I was dropping off my car for an oil change.
Okay, so it was a courtesy vehicle.
Uber guy.
An Uber courtesy vehicle.
And this guy, he's really good guy, retired corrections officer.
Oh, man.
I had a great ride over, and he listens to WAMC.
Well,
so
Sika, thank you very much. That's great. Thank you for guests of the roundtable are transported by Sika. Rosemary Armeo is here. She is an investigative journalist and our dear panelist. Good morning. How are you?
I'm a dear panelist?
Yeah.
Oh, I got a promotion.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going to just put your mic there in front of you, but good to have you here. Thank you.
Yes.
Good morning. We welcome preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
I'm great. I wish I could be there with you, but I am here in Massachusetts.
Therein lies the problem, right? But we're thrilled that you are with us, and thank you very much for being even through all of the miles, being with us and talking to us this morning. We greatly appreciate it. Let's get started on the issues of the day. Again, we welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll start off with the debt ceiling and the meeting between Biden and McCarthy that ended with no deal on Monday. Although both leaders expressed some optimism before attempting to revive stall talks ahead of a possible June 1st deadline. With as few as 10 days remaining until the U.S. government could default, President Biden on Monday resumed direct negotiations with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, hoping to resolve a stalemate over the debt ceiling that has started to spook Wall Street. The two men commenced the new round of talks after a weekend of turbulence and acrimony, and mere hours after the Treasury Department issued its latest warning, this time using more urgent language that the United States is, quote, highly likely to run out of cash and other options in early June, perhaps as soon as first of the month. June 1st is the deadline everyone seems to be using for some agreement to come into place. Publicly, Biden and McCarthy both appeared determined to try to project collegiality and optimism, having pilloried each other for months after House Republicans embarked on a campaign to leverage the debt ceiling to advance their political agenda. GOP lawmakers seek to slash federal health, education, science, labor, and research spending while preserving the defense budget with cuts far deeper than the White House is willing to support. Terry Gibson, we begin with you.
Well, I was just looking over this Marist poll, this Marist PBS poll that came out this morning or last night, where voters across the country really show how divided they are on this issue. And I think it also shows that the Republicans have a slight upper hand on the messaging and the leverage in this debate, and that there is signs that there could be significant damage directed towards Joe Biden if we were to go into default. And I think they're going to use that as long as they can to try to bring as much damage upon him as they can. I do think that's been part of the strategy all along. But it's a fine line, because the poll also shows that the Republican Party, could also be severely damaged if they push this too far. So I think that we're going to see some type of compromise here in the near future. Remember that whatever you're hearing from Joe Biden and Speaker McCarthy is not really reflective of what's going on behind the scenes. It's just the message they think their base needs to hear.
Dorsey.
Yeah, and just listening to the results of the poll, I think it speaks to the difference between informed voters and those who are not so informed. If you're paying close attention, then it's clear who is actually behind the holdup and using this as a political grandstand. I think in general, this is a roller coaster, a scary roller coaster ride that everybody wants to get off of, but it keeps going and it keeps going and it keeps going. And it really detracts from the initial intent of having a debt ceiling and this ability to increase it. It was instituted in 1917, I believe, with the purpose of ensuring that some of those who were in decision-making positions, not lawmakers, but in terms of spending, being able to control spending and not overstep when it came to legislators' ability to have a say in that spending. And so the reverse has actually happened, in which the lawmakers are using this as a political play. So it has really transition from the initial intent to become this political game that's used to stand firm on what you want. And so I think it's really unfortunate for the American people who are watching this play out. And I think everyone's talking about this June 1st deadline. What we've seen in the past is that even as we inch closer to the deadline, there are still economic implications for this country. So we can play this game the weeks, the days leading up to June 1st, but there are implications for every day that a decision is not reached. And so this goes back to the financial and economic security, not just of this country, but abroad, globally, everyone is watching this, and investors are getting very nervous. So I'm hoping that we can stop this roller coaster ride and we can all get off of it soon.
Rosemary Armeo.
So I'm going to start on what seems like a tangent, but there was a case in Florida that the Washington Post publicized this past week about a family caught up in their new horrible abortion rule. And the woman had a baby that had no chance of life. It had no lungs, no kidneys. It was not going to live. She was unable to get an abortion. She was forced to carry that baby for 12 weeks, and it lived for 90 minutes, gasping for breath because it has no lungs. It was a horrible, cruel, terrible thing. And I condemn the politicians who put her in that position. But I also wondered about all the doctors and nurses. There was no healthcare professional anywhere who could say, forget the rules, come on in, I'll take care of this for you. No one took a risk and took the chance that they would be hurt themselves by helping somebody else. And I feel like that's the same case that Biden is in now. Yes, this is directed at him. Yes, it's stupid. Yes, Democrats should have gotten rid of this debt limit voting long ago when they had a chance and they did not. And now he's stuck with it. So he's got to do something bold. I applaud him for negotiating with McCarthy, but I think it's like, who was the other Speaker of the House who made a big deal with Barack Obama? Remember him?
Paul Ryan?
No. The guy before him, the guy who smoked all the time and had the tan.
Oh, John Boehner.
John Boehner. And he, Boehner. Sorry. I'm losing my words. But Boehner and Obama came up with it.
Suddenly it's $25,000 pair. Smoking, tan, John Boehner.
Now I'm losing my narrative thread.
Sorry. Darn it.
Okay, so Boehner and Obama came up with a great plan, a great budget, a wonderful compromise, and it was blown up by Boehner's then, we thought, crazy Tea Party colleagues. McCarthy's in a worse position. Anything he agrees to with the president, anytime he comes out and says it was positive and hopeful, he goes back, and then the next thing you know, they're walking out again. Because I don't believe his colleagues actually want a deal at all, mm-hmm. which means Biden is going to be the one. He's going to have to stand up and do the 14th Amendment or the $1 trillion coin or something crazy. Or we're not going to get out of this. We're down to like 10 days now. So that's what I'm thinking.
J.P. Miller.
I agree with everything that Terry and Dorsey and Rosemary said. I look at it as two politicians are kind of on a tightrope right now, Biden and McCarthy. Both, I would say, good-intentioned people. Both want, you know, what's best for the country. I would say that, and both have to manage the moderates and the extremes in their party. And when this deal gets done, both are going to be attacked, you know, McCarthy's going to be attacked by the extreme right. Mm-hmm. Biden's going to be attacked by the far left. Mm. But hopefully, you know, I'm really encouraged that they're meeting frequently, and it seems like they're making progress. I think you'll see as we get down to this deadline, you may see some stock market volatility mm-hmm. that is going to scare Biden and scare McCarthy into saying, okay, we need to do this. You know, when the stock market starts having its jitters, it's going to be... could be a catalyst for them, and I'm hopeful it happens soon. I agree with you, Dorsey, on the market jitters. That I think is going to be, until that happens, you may see delays, but once it does happen, it'll be quick.
Mm-hmm. The market is so fickle, though. You don't know what at any given time how they're going to react, right?
Well, I was just watching yesterday. On the news, there was reference to someone using AI to depict the Pentagon being blown up. I don't mm-hmm. know if you all saw that.
Yeah, we did.
And the market was impacted just from this. It wasn't even real. So it speaks to how fickle and how nervous people are. So we definitely need to be very conscious of that.
And as that happens in the market, what you have to remember is both the president and the speaker are getting telephone calls from the CEO of JP Morgan, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, the CEO of Google, saying you need to get this done. You know, our economy is in trouble, and having being directly lobbied by those people who control and have vision and sight on what our economy is actually doing, I think is impactful for our elected leaders.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to keep in mind that the rest of the world is watching, and especially those who would like to bring harm upon the United States are watching, and they're looking for an opportunity, possibly a weakness in our system. We can't make the mistake of just assuming that the whole world and life in general is just going to go on and wait while they decide what to do. If there is a terrorist strike, if there is a natural disaster, if there is anything that sort of disrupts the normal of day-to-day life, that's going to have a huge impact on this decision-making process as well.
And yet, we all know this, we all know the dangers, and we're still in this situation. No one's, it's a horrible game of chicken, and I feel powerless. There's nothing we can do. We're making all a lot of sense here this morning, but what good does that do anything? It's on Biden.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But JP brought up this, thinking about the far left, the far right, and I think if we, just looking at some of the decisions that have played out across the country and our state houses, people are determined to draw the line in the sand, stand firmly and say, I'm not budging. I'm not moving. I don't care at what cost. So that is very concerning when you think about how polarized this issue is and everything that's baked into the equation, that we could find ourselves in a place where people are so headstrong, entrenched in the politics of the day, that we cannot get to the decision that needs to be reached, and it will take Biden at that point. I agree with that.
Hey, this has been happening since the Tea Party, when the whole idea of compromise became, nope, I'm not compromising, and gerrymandering has made it completely possible. You don't have to compromise or govern anymore. You just state your position, you stand for it no matter what, and you get rewarded for that with votes. It is the flaw that our enemies are looking for in our system. There it is, right there.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your thoughts on the discussion this morning about the debt ceiling. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Terry Gibson. Well, I don't have time to read everyone's name, so I'll just say I'll introduce them when we come back after this. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Really nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning, 9:35 on the 23rd of May. We've been talking about the debt ceiling, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome your letters. We would love to hear them. I'm curious as Rosemary, when you talk about deadline and we look at June 1st and that obviously the markets and so forth, but it always seems, is it going to be short term? Is it going to be long term? The agreement that comes and knowing how they play this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best that Biden and we can hope for is that they'll come up with a deal that covers the remaining, 2 years or so in his administration. And they'll give back money that was supposed to be out from the bailout funds and some other like minor things. Most of what they're asking for is so utterly ridiculous, despite the conversation on the roundtable yesterday with John Faso. Most of the rules they're calling for on work are already in place. It's not going to make a big difference. They're asking for...
Oh, you listened to that, did you?
I did. Screaming, screaming at the radio. Thank you very much. But it's all crap, what he said and what McCarthy is saying. And even if Biden gave into it, they would go back, and you can be sure there's no more demands that will come out because they don't really want a deal. They want the negotiating position.
JP?
Yeah, I think that they – my view is that – and I could be wrong. My view is they want a deal, but they want to exact as much pain and as many concessions as Biden is willing to give them, so that at the end of this, you know, at the end of this, when it happens, Biden is going to claim victory and McCarthy is going to claim victory. And the Republicans have a big incentive to get as many concessions as possible so that they can go to their members and go to the public and say, look, the president gave on X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, whereas the president is going to want to say, we saved the country from the brink of disaster. We got some Republicans together. We got some Democrats together. And we made something happen so that he, in 2024, can go for re-election as a moderate bridge builder between, you know, the various factions of our country.
Dorsey? Or go ahead, Terry.
I was just going to kind of follow up on what Rosemary said about the ridiculousness of the work requirements they're trying to impose.
Related to the
SNAP benefits. What's happening now, because we are in such dire straits, is that it's not ultimately in the end really going to be about whether what they say they have done actually does anything. It's more about being able to justify being able to say it. So, yes, the work requirements are not really going to change anything, but for them to be able to come up in front of a microphone and say that we've changed the work requirements, that's what's important to them, to be able to say it.
It's all performative, right?
Which is what's so ridiculous about all of this, because we're going to go through all of this, and at the end of it, whatever problems may exist in our budgeting and our economy and our spending, none of it's going to really be addressed. And that's the sad part about how divided our country is right now, is that we just can't solve the problem.
Yeah, it seems like they learned their lesson putting McCarthy into the speakership. And now they're doing the same thing. They're going to exact one demand after another, stretch out the negotiations. How many was that, 14 voting rounds? We're in round about 12 on this one. And you're right. They win no matter what we end up with. And they're holding us hostage. It's so maddening.
Yes, we have a lot of letters that have questions and or comments about the maddening situation. John says approving the debt ceiling money already spent is separate from approving a budget. This issue is like all other legislation where each individual item is up for a vote tied to other issues attached to the same bill, some not even distantly related in subject or scope. Vote on every single issue separately on separate bills in Congress. If the Republicans want to hold the nation's integrity hostage merely because of politics, let the nation default and make it clear it is them that are at fault. That never seems to work, though, does it?
No.
No. All right.
Like logic. Logic does not work right now.
Politics 101. Logic usually doesn't work. Leonard, why do people think that claiming that the extremes of both parties are somehow equal? The far right wants to outlaw trans people and keep the poor poor while enriching themselves. The left wants to make sure everyone has a place to live and food to eat. Clearly, they both must be stopped. I understand the point of the message. Then we go to Scott. At what point does McCarthy start working with moderate Democrats to get votes instead of bending over backwards for the MAGA fringe, who, as you say, don't want an agreement? Anybody on that?
I see no signs that he's bending to do that. He seems to be embracing that fringe. He and Marjorie are like best friends now, right?
BFX.
Well, yeah, this fringe is incredibly vocal. They're hostile. Mm-hmm. They have a huge following. Yep. They have a huge microphone. It's like he spends his entire day with these individuals walking around with a megaphone held up to his ear screaming at him. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to escape them. It's very hard to avoid them. It's very hard to compete with them on the public level.
And basically, he's not a strong and principled and smart man. So, of course, he's not standing up to them.
Yes. Anyone else on that?
I was just going to follow up on the performative. I suspect that some of it is performative, and then I think that these are people who really feel in their heart of heart, in their gut, that they are doing right by, quote-unquote, the American people, which is their base. There are people who feel that there's some that are worthy of government bailout, government backing. They are anti-taxing the wealthy, but then they want to put in place work requirements for people on welfare. So I think some of the folks who are standing firm that we're talking about, this is not just performance. This is a values stance that they're taking in terms of who they feel is worthy and who isn't. And so, again, it's a very dangerous and slippery slope.
We go to this letter from JD, who says, can any of the panelists describe what is considered the far left in this country? It is people who want universal health care like every other first world country has. Is it wanting the poorest in our country to be housed and fed? The use of this term by this panel is disturbing. Does anyone want to talk about the far left?
I'm happy to chime in here. When I hear far left, what I understand and what I mean is that you do have elected officials who ideally want to live in a world where no one is homeless, everyone has housing. And I want the same things. But the reality is you have to think about the practicality of things, the cost of things. And so it's not to say that we should not all strive to get there, but we have to get there. And so when you take a firm stance on a political issue without being willing to budge, it creates a dynamic in which nothing gets done because you are, in fact, doing exactly what the other end of the spectrum is doing, and that's not willing to compromise. And I completely understand people, the sentiment that we've compromised for far too long and there's a sense of urgency on many of these issues. I agree with that. but there is still a process that plays out, and there's some brass tacks and practicality that has to be considered in order for things to get done.
Yeah, I think that describes Bernie's whole career. Great ideas, absolutely idealistic, totally right, but no practical measure to put any of it into place so far, or very much of it into place. And that's it. So there's an intransigence and a desire to press forward no matter the outcome, just for the principle of it. That's a whole lot different than the extreme on the right, which is willing to go to violence, demeaning of people, horrible cruelty. You're not seeing that on the left, and the two are not comparable.
Correct.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We have more letters, and I think we have more opinions from our panel members. We will get to all of those. I promise you, we'll get to all of those after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. I promised I was going to reintroduce everybody. I didn't do that when I came back from the last break. So Dorsey Appliers is here, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and J.P. Miller. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We go back to letters. We have many. Ian writes, the answer to this issue is simple. Give the Republicans all the cuts they demand, but only in their states. There you go. Then we go to this from John, given inflation, even if spending is at the current rate, isn't that in itself, Yeah, and then there's another word that doesn't, I don't think is a word. Anyway, timely spending less. If that is so, Republicans calling for cost cutting is even more cruel and draconian. I will say I butchered that. Well, I didn't. There's words missing, so I apologize. Let's go to John, another John. Oh, maybe this is no. That still doesn't have words. Okay. Then we go to Eric, who says GOP wants cuts on social programs. Dems want to close tax loopholes. Let's do both and start really tackling the debt issue.
All of that is fine, but it has nothing to do with the debt ceiling, which is demands immediate action to pay bills.
Right. Yeah.
And if we really want to fix everything, then just like withdraw the Trump tax cuts.
We go to Kenny, who says it's impossible for us to run out of money. We will just publish more, print more, I assume. Right. The president is constitutionally obligated to make sure the country does not default on its debt.
Lawrence Tribe just came out with he's a constitutional scholar and a liberal, which is why John Faso, again, yesterday, not to harp on that, poo-pooed him.
Not
but he
all.
Came out with the whole thing about how, yes, it's completely constitutional for the president to keep paying, to either issue a big trillion-dollar coin or to use the 14th Amendment. The problem is that it's not a permanent solution. It would immediately be adjudicated, which puts the whole debt ceiling still in the area of controversy and confusion and uncertainty. So is it ultimately good for the economy? I mean, I guess he's going to weigh what's worse for the economy, defaulting or taking a position that will be unclear for many months before it's decided ultimately by the Supreme Court. And that's so fascinating because many people are saying the originalists would have to go with the ability to use the 14th Amendment, which says we have to pay all our bills. However, it's very confusing, the original intent of those framers. This is in the 14th Amendment, which came after the Civil War, and it was actually to take care of Confederate debts. It really had nothing to do with the U.S. debt. Would they take that into consideration? So it's very much up in the air where this Supreme Court would come out. And there would, where would we be then? A year or so after this is all decided, we'd be in default again? I mean, the best you could hope for is take this action, then you get a Democratic majority in to take both houses, and they get rid of this whole idea of voting on the debt limit. And that's very risky.
Terry? JP?
Sorry, I was...
You were muted.
You were not listening to me?
I was listening. I think Rosemary should just run for Congress. She has a great platform. I support. I would vote for her.
I really like to, but that whole raising money thing is scary. Plus, I'm old. You know, I'm a big ageist.
Well, now that you've told everyone.
Well, I know. That's true. I'd have to lie. Oh, yeah, that's done, too, all the time. I could be Santos, Rosemary Santos. I'm 23. Yeah.
Terry? Did you have anything to say?
No, I know you were going to call on JP, so I don't want to stand in the way.
JP?
I, too, think Rosemary should run for Congress. I also agree that this debt limit thing coming up every couple of years and bringing us to the brink is just not a good use of our time. Our country and our elected officials have a lot of other and very important things to tackle. And this is consuming all of our attention, all of the elected officials' attention, all of the media's attention every couple of years. For what? You know, it seems ridiculous to me.
I guess the question is then, would we have enough votes to reverse this debt ceiling?
It's questionable even if you have all the Democratic votes, because as soon as you do, you got to deal with the Manchin cinema problem.
Exactly.
So,
it's wishful thinking. Wishful thinking.
That's why I think Biden ought to be doing a lot of listening to lawyers about the 14th Amendment. That's looking more and more like his escape hatch.
Are you being bombed?
Yeah, what is that?
Terry, are you all right? Are you
out of the airfield
again?
I didn't realize you could hear that. I live near a municipal airport.
Jeez.
So... Yeah, there is
you're
that noise.
Flying into to join us. We didn't know you had an airport close by. You could just fly in and do the show.
Yeah. Got my plane there. I'm ready to go.
All right, let's go back to letters. We go to this one that says, JP is right. Yes, at the end of the day, a deal will be signed and both sides will claim victory. That will happen. What won't happen is either side doing anything meaningful about the fact that nobody can adequately support themselves, much less their family, on anything close to the minimum wage.
You know, this poll, the Marist poll that we were just talking about, has some other questions in it not related to the debt ceiling. And I think one of the last questions is about the support for raising the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, to $15, and it has the majority of people support it, so that is a possibility moving forward.
No, it isn't. Just because people support it, come on, Terry. We support abortion rights. We support gun regulation. We don't have that either.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply it was that simple, okay. But it continues to be a talking point that I think. I do think at some point in the future we will see a change in that. We'll have to, because at some point people just can no longer – well, already they can't afford to pay their rent and buy groceries. So it's only going to get worse.
It's tough too. You know, in New York State just passed a minimum wage increase, but you also – so that's one headline. And then the other headline is you see that rents throughout the state, and especially in New York City and the suburbs of New York City – have skyrocketed to a basically unattainable level for people to afford. So you get a little bit of a percentage in the minimum wage, but rents are outpacing that, and cost of living is outpacing it. And you wonder about, could there ever be a minimum wage to get you to that level so that you could have a reasonable standard of living if you're a minimum wage worker?
We're so far behind. I don't think that we, unless there are drastic changes and made, we will continue to be behind when it comes to how much people actually earn and what they can afford.
Let's see. We go to, I thought we had one more letter here, maybe two, before we go to the top here. Let me see. One moment while I wait for my computer.
Exciting radio.
See what it does there? So you click on it, right, Rosemary?
That's obnoxious. That happens on my phone.
It
does killer.
It's there, but it's not
so
populating.
That's right.
So the is that internet or what is that? Is that the computer?
I don't know. I don't want to know.
Yeah. Oh, you don't want to know.
It's bad. I don't like it because you know it's there, but it's not there yet.
You know, Joe, if you're not able to do this job, they can make a robot now that can do it.
No, I know. I know. Absolutely.
So you better figure this out.
Although if that robot needs Wi-Fi, good luck.
That's right.
All right. So I will. I'll let this reboot, and I'll just make up stuff in the meantime. When we'll take a break at the top of the hour, and when we come back, hopefully things will my technical issues will be solved. When you think of, I assume. Does anybody want to guess? But I assume this will be our top topic from now, probably now until June 1st.
Agreed.
Right.
Or yeah. Until there's a settlement,
which will probably be around June 1st, mm-hmm. wouldn't you think? I mean, yes. Right? I mean, I'm just rationally thinking that they'll probably bring it up to the last moment.
The question is Memorial Day weekend? Do these folks want their Memorial Day weekend ruined, or do they want to have something done before then? I imagine that it's probably going to go past Memorial Day weekend, but that is a big landmark, of course, coming before June 1st, that it is kind of the kickoff to the summer. And people are going to want to be having fun. And if the stock market is tanking, people are going to have less fun over Memorial Day weekend than they would otherwise.
Well, one of the things that happens on Memorial Day weekend is that every politician, especially those that are running in tight races, wants to be in every Memorial Day parade. They want to speak at every Memorial Day event. And the last thing you want to do when you show up at those events is have this dark cloud of national debt hanging over your head, of a possible default on loans, of looking at elder citizens and saying that your Social Security check isn't going to show up next month. They don't want to face that. So I think the Memorial Day weekend may play in the favor of getting this wrapped up.
Well, I don't know, because I think some of these elected officials feel that they're making a strong stand for their base. And so I don't know if they necessarily see this as a dark cloud.
Terry, how many of
them? Well, when their base is Social Security check doesn't show up in the mail, or their base's Medicare payments aren't made, or Medicaid isn't available, or whatever the cost cutting effort is, they're going to speak up. I mean, I think at some point they're going to have to face this.
I'm just curious, Terry, how many of those Memorial Day things did you do when you're a state senator?
Everyone I could fit into the schedule. some days, five, six at a time. I remember one time, I think we did like seven parades in like a day, and except we couldn't finish any of the parades. I would like march in half the parade, and somebody would pick me up, and we would drive over and jump into the middle of the next parade. Yeah, it's
very
that kind
crafty.
Of
very nice.
Well, that's what you got to do.
That's right. That's right. All right.
And even then, that's not enough sometimes.
Well, at least you're not bitter. We'll take a break, and we'll be back. We have Dorsey of Players, J.P. Miller, Rosemary Armeo, and Terry Gibson. We'll be back and continue our conversation after news with Ray Graff. Getting a lot of letters about the music. Tinsley Ellis is the performer. Great stuff that we're hearing this morning. Don't forget, we always have a playlist. You can go to our playlist at wamc.org/roundtable and check it out. And we'll tell you when and what you heard. So if you say, what did I hear at 10:06? And it'll tell you what you heard at 10:06. And if you look and you can't find it, I promise you it's there. Okay. But good morning. Welcome back. We have our great group this morning, Dorsey of Players, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and J.P. Miller. And we welcome you, panel at wamc.org. I want to get into a new topic this morning. Actually, just a couple. Let me go to a couple more letters today. I was under the impression that if the president invokes the 14th Amendment, writes Ellen, the Supreme Court has to approve it. If that's the case, won't Biden lose?
they don't have to approve it. They most likely will be asked to approve it by a lawsuit that will immediately challenge it in our partisan way. And as I said before, I think it's up in the air what they would decide. Originalist rule on that panel, and you would think that they would say, well, it's right there in the 14th Amendment that president, you know, bills have to be paid, and so the president doing that would be allowed. However, the 14th Amendment was written after the Civil War. It has to do with Confederate debt, not U.S. debt. It's never been tested before, so it's really unclear what the court would rule.
We also go to this letter. It's going well, Rosemary. If the feds were to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, what would stop the private industry from turning to more AI? How about giving tax breaks to all employers for hiring real people? The more employees you bring on, the better chance at receiving a better corporate tax rate.
Well, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing stopping corporate America or any employer, for that matter, from looking for ways to reduce labor right now through AI and any other form of technology. That's been going on for decades and will continue to go on. I don't really think the two are really related. I think that, as Dorsey mentioned before, we're so far behind in paying people a living wage and what they really need to survive in a decent way, in a respectful way, in a way where they can really, you know, put savings away and live a safe and healthy life. We're so far behind in that even $15 an hour doesn't even get close to what people are going to need.
We go to Ross, who says the American people, especially the American right, have elected plain-speaking politicians who have dumbed down their constituents and have no understanding of macroeconomics and global economic fundamentals. They continuously compare budget talks and debt to family home economics. The money spent is already in use for U.S. development, which is how you increase wealth. The money goes to communities, contractors, business development, community health and education, and benefit of global policy, etc. That from Ross. Then we go to this letter from Melinda. So do all these far-right people not care about their own Social Security checks and Medicare coverage or their retirement accounts invested wherever? They, too, will lose along with all the rest of us.
I don't think they depend on Social Security.
All right.
You don't have to be that smart to get elected to Congress.
Maybe I will run.
All right. Let's move on to another topic this morning. Again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We go to, let's see. I would like to talk next about E. Jean Carroll seeking damages from Donald Trump for the comments he made during the CNN town hall. The author recently won a $5 million judgment against former President Donald Trump in a civil lawsuit. And then attorneys for Carroll filed an amended complaint on Monday and a separate, still pending defamation lawsuit. They said they would seek at least $10 million in damages for comments Trump made at the primetime event on May 1st at CNN's town hall, where he made disparaging comments. The lawsuit was originally filed over comments Trump made about Carroll in 2019. When he was president, she had first publicly accused him of a decades-old sexual assault. The lawsuit has been delayed by appellate litigation having to do with whether Trump is shielded from liability because he was president at the time he made those comments. In the CNN special this month, Trump, who left office in 2021 and is again seeking the White House, echoed some of his past comments about Carroll, including that he had never met her before and that she was lying and that she was mentally unstable. At various points, he denied that anything happened with Carroll, but also seemed to shame her for the assault, she says, happened in a Bergdorf Goodman dressing room after a chance encounter. What kind of woman meets somebody and brings them up, and within minutes, you're playing hanky-panky in a dressing room, okay? Trump said. On Tuesday, the day after Carroll's complaint was amended, Trump disparaged her again on his Truth Social saying he wouldn't want to know or touch her and that she had peddled a fake made-up story. Writing in all caps, "It never happened, is a total scam, unfair trial," exclamation point.
He's such a pig. Ugh. As I called on the program like the day after the roundtable, the town hall, saying I hope she brings another suit. I guess the lawyers figured out that amending an existing suit was the way to go, but it's the same effect. He shows such a deep lack of respect for the rule of law. One day after he is found guilty, I mean, that's... I know it's not a criminal case, but pay money. You did it. He's out repeating the same crime for which he was supposed to be punished. And so I applaud her for doing this. I think that she continues to put herself right on the edge. She's going to win no friends among Trump's many fans for doing this. But she is right. I think it's also, maybe it will play into today, a judge is supposed to open a hearing in the Alvin Bragg case against Trump on his falsifying business records. And he's going to lay down the law on what Trump can and cannot say about the case. I am sure that this case, the sex case, has to affect what he's going to say.
Yeah, and there's no way that you could ever imagine a scenario where he's muzzled or not feel or doesn't feel completely free to discuss whatever he wants. So this is going to, he will certainly disparage her more in public in the upcoming presidential debates and in other town halls there's just no stopping him from saying what he thinks is right or what he wants to say. And I'm not a legal expert. I don't know whether you can continue to have new lawsuits or whether you just tack on to your existing lawsuit. But happy she's doing it.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. I was paying attention and said, "You go, girl." I'm happy that she is doing her part to change the culture, especially as it relates to Donald Trump. He should not be exempt from being held accountable when you are publicly making racist and sexist comments about other people. Mm-hmm. We have seen recently, whether you are Don Lemon or whoever you are, if you make certain comments that people feel are inappropriate, that you should be held accountable, then there are consequences. And the same should be applicable to Donald Trump. He has been able to say and do whatever he wants. And as a result, he feels very comfortable, as you pointed out, in a short period of time, doing the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. So I think if more people speak out, hold him accountable, we could see a change in this perception that he has, that he is untouchable.
Terry?
I agree with everything everyone is saying. I don't have a lot of hope or a lot of faith that anything will stop him at this point.
He
really has nothing to lose. He's got so many court cases against him. He's already looking at just sort of an incomprehensible amount of fines being possibly levied at him and even possible jail time. And he seems to have figured out how to manipulate the legal system to appeal every time something comes up. I mean, this current case is being appealed. I think he's going to get, the only choice he really has is to speak up and just get louder and louder and louder. And I don't know where that ends. I don't see an end to it. I think, to me, the real end will come if there ever comes a time when that mass of people that continue to support him finally fades out to a smaller number, to where there just isn't enough people to care anymore about what he says.
That seems less likely than him changing, than him pivoting. Yeah. I think the best we can hope for is that Jean Carroll is going to have a very comfortable life from now on. So yes. her suffering has paid off a bit, monetarily at least.
And he gets louder and louder until he's silenced. And that's where you hold others accountable for not giving him a platform to spew some of the sexist and racist comments that he's traditionally made. So I agree. I think for some, and I can understand the perspective, it's a lost cause, but that's when he needs to be silenced.
If the only way to truly silence him is, well, there's two ways. One is just letting nature take its course, which eventually will happen, I assume, unless he's a robot. The other one is to put him in jail.
Took a turn. And, go ahead.
You know, put him in jail. That would silence him. But the idea of Donald Trump being actually put in jail is getting harder and harder to believe that that could happen.
One of his lawyers, Ty Cobb, just said recently he thought he was going to end up in jail over the Mar-a-Lago documents. Do you disagree with that, Harry? He said he's in a lot of trouble.
I haven't seen enough detail about that case to really decide one way or the other. Listen, I hope so. I'll be there applauding as he puts on the orange suit.
Because I had said it with you that he'll never go to jail. We don't put rich white guys in jail, rich, powerful white guys. But when Ty Cobb said it, it was like, oh, maybe there's some possibility.
JP?
What I would say, Terry, is he was kind of silenced for the last year and a half in that the mainstream media was not covering him or everything that he said or everything that he tweeted or Truth Socialed out. And so he was relatively silent. Of course, his followers could listen and tune into what he's saying. But for the vast majority of Americans who, he was relatively silent. And what you've seen over the last month or two is the solidification ever since Alvin Bragg indicted him. He has been solidified even more so as the front runner for the Republican nomination. You see CNN and other mainstream outlets are now going to be forced to cover him. And that CNN town hall is what is the venue with which he uttered these comments, which E. Jean Carroll is going to sue him for. And so I do think he was relatively silenced for a while, and we unfortunately are going to have the next 18 months where we are going to be enduring a campaign of him versus the president for the presidency.
But now the only difference is that we now do have a significant number of presidential candidates, many of which are credible candidates running on the Republican line against him. And I do think that the media will need to cover those candidates as well as we move along. And the only thing I would take issue with in what you said, JP, is just the use of the word force. Nobody forced CNN to host that town hall. Nobody's forcing the media to cover him the way that they do.
And no one's going to force the media to cover them all equally. We had an election in 2016 and another in 2020 where there were lots of candidates, and only one got the majority of media attention, and that was Donald Trump. He has an ability. He has, I've called it charisma, which many listeners object to, but that's what it is. He pulls in viewers. Yeah. He is a showman. Yeah, he's P.T. Barnum of politics. And we watch and listen to him, so he is a draw both monetarily for stations looking to get viewers. Politically, he's important. He is going to get lots of coverage. And I'm sorry, Scott and Nikki Haley can't even begin to touch that. Not begin to. DeSantis will see. He has an ability to do really stupid things that get him a lot of coverage, too. Banning books, fighting Disney. How about that? Vote for this guy. He just cost Florida, 2,000 jobs and $1 billion development. Disney is playing revenge politics as hard as he is. That'll get coverage.
All right.
I'm done ranting.
That wasn't a rant. I've heard your rants. I was on a rant. All right, let's go to other topics here on this Tuesday morning and move on. We'd love to hear from you, panel at WAMC.org. I find this to be a really interesting story, and I think, you can just imagine, you can put yourself into the into the minds of the parents and put them and think about this. But barely 2 months after an armed assailant fatally shot 3 children and 3 adults at a private Christian school in Nashville, the lack of information about the motive has led to a bitter legal fight over whether handwritten journals and writings found during a search of the shooter's home and car should be released to the public. This from the New York Times. I'm just going to separate for a second and say that you'll recall yesterday we had a story about tomorrow marks the 1 year anniversary of Uvalde. And after 1 year, they're still looking for information. And here, 2 months, they're looking for key information in Nashville. Caught in between the arguments about the constitutional right to access public records and a political dispute over gun control legislation are the parents from about 100 families of the Covenant School who have made clear that they want the material to remain locked away, at least until the surviving classmates finish out the school year. It is such a heavy burden for them to put themselves back in the middle of all this when they are just trying to heal, according to Eric Osborne, a lawyer for the families, saying at a court hearing on Monday. Clearly, they wouldn't be doing this if they didn't earnestly believe that the release of these writings were going to have a very negative effect on them. Journalists, a gun rights group, and others have sued to force the release of the writings, but much of the hearing was dedicated to whether Tennessee law allowed parents, the school itself, and the companion church on campus to have a legal voice in the dispute, a question that the judge said she would answer by the end of the day tomorrow. You want to take the journalist perspective on this?
No, the journalist perspective is just clear. I would want to see every word, every bit of footage, which I guess the parents now have seen. I would want everything. Shootings, public shootings, mass shootings in schools are of utmost importance to the public. It is a matter of policy and concern, whatever. It's the highest level. I would fight all the way to get that.
And what the part? Go ahead, Terry.
Well, I don't want to interrupt Rosemary.
No. That's go ahead.
The part of the story that really upsets me is that the Republican Party there in Tennessee is saying that before they can address any type of legislation that would curb gun violence or reduce the amount of guns on the street, they need to see what this person had to say. That, to me, that argument is just so awful. I mean, people are dead. What more evidence do you need? What more? And before these people were dead, there were lots of other people that were dead because of gun violence. What this person had to say about why he did this, I do think should be made public, but should that be the reason we're holding up on putting laws
Good
in
point.
Place and actually help protect people? Yeah. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, what could be in there that would make a difference in the legislation you would come up with or decide not to come up with, really?
Well, I'm sure they'll find something, and that's what they're hoping for.
Yeah.
They're looking for an excuse.
An excuse.
I mean,
yeah.
My understanding is, based on what the police have said, and I think part of the problem here, too, is that the police have leaked out some information, or either leaked it out or purposely shared it, which has only piqued the interest of many people to hear more. I guess one of the things is apparently this person who did the shooting claimed to have been transgender. And, of course, if that turns out to be true and there's things written in there about that, you can only imagine how the Republican Party
will deal
with that.
Dorsey, what do you make of the parents' arguments of not wanting this out there to protect their children?
I'm with the parents. I think there should be a level of sensitivity to those who are dealing with the trauma. I mean, everyone is dealing with the trauma of these mass shootings, but the parents and the classmates are dealing with the trauma in a very different way. And so at the very least, the parents are saying, at least allow our children to complete the school year before this traumatic these letters and the journal is exposed, I think we should be sensitive to that. What are we looking for? And everybody has an answer to that, but for those who are anti-gun legislation and reform, this is really about finding a distraction. So to the point about this person potentially being transgender, that becomes the issue versus the fact that this person, regardless of how they identify, chose to pick up a weapon and kill other people. That is the real issue here, and the fact that we need to do something about how loose our gun laws are. So what's the why here? And so I struggle with, we want immediate gratification, information at all costs, at all times. In this case, does it have to be released at this moment? And then the other piece that was brought up was, in the past, when some of the writings of some of these killers have come forward, it has been used as a playbook for others who are interested in carrying out similar actions. And so this becomes a motivation to, what is suspected to become a motivation to act out similar behavior, because you have a playbook that you now idolize.
Right.
So
can I respond? I wish we had asked her first, because that's the argument you get every time the media goes after information. A race car driver is killed. His family doesn't want to see his autopsy pictures in the public, so they fight to shut it down, and the state of Florida shuts down records on all drag car races, which stops safety and legislative action on both spectator and driver safety. There is nothing good comes from withholding information. You say the real issues here. We don't know what the real issues are until we see all of the information, including what this person wrote.
We know what the real issue is. At the end of the day, there are people dead. That's the real issue.
That's right. And they're dead, and those kids saw a gunman come into their classroom and threaten their very sense of security, killed their friends. There's nothing a newspaper or a radio station can do that is anywhere near that. These kids are not going to be hurt by release of the information.
So why do they all not want to have it released?
Because that's,
why are all the families demanding it not be released?
Because that's what we always
do. Republicans, Democrats, they all say, don't release it. Let's worry about the kids. And the media says, no, we have to know. We're going to sell newspapers. We're going to have all this stuff splashed all over the front page of the tabloids. We're going to have the killers. We're going to have the killers photograph all over the front page of the newspaper. Their names. We're going to know everything about them. We're going to have the pictures of their freaky, bedroom walls with all the scribble and all this stuff. And it goes on to inspire other killers when they see that. And they tell their friends, I am going to be in the newspaper tomorrow.
Like,
watch
that.
Out. I'm going to be in the newspaper.
Do I get to respond, or do you have
to
take a break?
We have one minute, but we have a minute, but okay. And then you can break on the other side. And I just also want to add to this, they're also asking for just till the end of the school year, which I assume isn't that far away, right?
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. I have no problem waiting till the end of the school year, which is about a month. But this is an argument that you get all the time. Like, don't even name the person who did the shooting, because that glorifies them. No, we heard the same thing with, don't publicize teenage suicides, because that'll lead to copycats. It's the same thing I'm hearing.
And they don't
now.
Do that.
They increasingly
they do
are because
they don't do it.
Listen,
because they know,
and they don't name rape victims either, because it's a tradition, and we want to look
like
we're sensitive.
They don't put it in because they know it encourages others. Same thing with mass shooters.
It doesn't.
It's well documented.
It's not well documented.
The media says, no, we need this. We need them on the front page of the paper. We need to put monster the front page of the Daily News with the Buffalo guy.
You
need to have that.
Not putting teenage suicide news stories in has stopped the rate of teenage suicide.
We'll take a break.
Suicide.
They'll keep going. We'll be back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Dorsey Appleers, Terry Gibson, J.P. Miller, and Rosemary Armeo making up the panel this morning. We appreciate you. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to chime in. The mics went off and the discussion just kept going on there, and that was fine. That's very good. Would you like to give a summation, J.P., of what we discussed during the break over the past 3 minutes?
I don't know if I could do a summation, but I would say is Rosemary knows a ton about this subject, and she has a principled view that is rooted in a career of studying this. I happen to really disagree with her on this. I unfortunately get a little emotional about mass shootings. I hate to read about them. I hate to talk about them. But that's my perspective.
It's a difficult situation because I feel like I'm forced to argue against being sensitive or kind to people who are in bad straits. But I know that's not the duty of journalism. My duty is not to the parents, not to the children who survived, but to the larger community that has to know about what happened and why and who was involved. And I don't think that there's credible evidence that hiding stuff, keeping it out of the news, leads to any sort of reform. It didn't happen with abortion. It didn't happen with incest. It didn't. You name any suicide. All of these things have continued. Mass shootings, with or without the media. If you see the media as the problem, you're just deflecting from the real situation, which is guns.
Terry Gibson.
You know, there is a lot of evidence out there to show that if we were to ban assault rifles and the types of weapons that are being used in these mass shootings, that we would save lives and we would have a lot less of these incidents occurring, and we would have to have this debate about this issue a lot less. And I guess what I want to see is the country focused on passing that type of legislation at the federal level so that we don't have to have these arguments so often. But in the meantime, I totally sympathize with the parents. I totally understand why you would not want this information to be released. But if we're going to live in a country where you can go out at basically any age and get your hands on just about any weapon of choice and live in a world where you're constantly exposed to all types of violence on social media, TV, and movies that really encourage and glorify the use of guns, then I think we have to deal with the consequences of that as well. And one of the consequences is learning more about these individuals and trying to use that in a way that can hopefully benefit society by understanding how their minds work. But I really disagree, too. And what I really fear is that those who do not want any laws to infringe upon gun rights, that they will use the findings of what these individuals write or say before conducting these killings. They'll use that as a way to justify not passing laws, and I worry about that.
Anybody else? All right, let's move on to another topic this morning, and probably our last one that we'll have time for. Maybe not. We'll see how we do. Let's talk about, would you like to talk about Meta, or would you like to talk about the Colorado River? Anyone? I find the Colorado River story fascinating.
Okay, let's do that one.
This is... There's an agreement. It's basically, this is the game that we're playing. Who gets the water? Arizona, California, and Nevada have agreed to take less water from the drought-strained Colorado River, a breakthrough agreement that for now keeps the river from falling so low that it would jeopardize water supplies for major cities like Phoenix and Los Angeles, as well as for some of America's most productive farmland. The agreement announced Monday calls for the federal government to pay about $1.2 billion to irrigation districts, cities, and Native American tribes in the three states if they temporarily use less water. The states have also agreed to make additional cuts beyond the ones tied to the federal payments to generate the total reductions needed to prevent the collapse of the river. Taken together, these reductions would amount to about 13% of the total water use in the lower Colorado Basin, among the most aggressive ever experienced in the region, and likely to require significant water restrictions for residential and agricultural uses. The Colorado River supplies drinking water to 40 million Americans in seven states, as well as parts of Mexico, and irrigates 5.5 million acres of farmland. The electricity generated by dams on the river's two main reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, powers millions of homes and businesses. But drought, population growth, and climate change have dropped the river's flows by one-third in recent years compared with historical averages, threatening to provoke a water and power catastrophe across the West. One more nugget here. California, Arizona, and Nevada get their share of water from Lake Mead, which is formed by the Colorado River at the Hoover Dam and is controlled by the federal government. The Bureau of Reclamation, an agency within the Interior Department, determines how much water each of the three states receives. The other states that depend on the Colorado get water directly from the river and its tributaries. So this is what we are coming to in the allocation of something that is scarce, water. Who would like to go first, JP?
Okay. what I would say is that you're going to see water in the coming years become more and more like something like we think of as oil, in that how it flows, who's getting it, is going to become a bigger and bigger issue. It's remarkable that these three states came together and figured it out. I think a lot of the, I forget whether it's seven or eight states that border the Great Lakes, which form a compact and decide what happens with the water in the Great Lakes, how that's decided. But this is something that we are going to continue to hear more and more of, especially with the dramatic change in weather patterns that we've seen, especially this year.
Yeah, it's I hope Republican politicians are looking at this. Climate change is real, guys. Look at this. And as historic and momentous as it is, it's not enough. They're just taking less water. It's not like they're leaving it, like letting it build up. The humans have the ability to deflate, to collapse a river. That's the word they're using, collapse a river, which ought to be terrifying. And the thing that will change are dietary changes, where we eat too much dairy and meat, beef, and most of the water, like 37% of the water in that river goes to grow alfalfa and other feed for beef lots,
right,
beef cattle. We can't do that. It's not sustainable. And we've built a whole economy in that area. The agriculture is built on the idea that there was cheap, available water. Almond trees use an enormous amount of water. So does alfalfa. And again, it was built on this idea that the Colorado River would always be there. And it isn't. And it's going away really fast. And it should be a wake-up call. The Salt Lake, Great Salt Lake, is disappearing as well. The whole West is drying out. And that is not politics. That is nothing more than climate change and human overuse. So it can be fixed, but will it, and in time?
I mean, this is very anecdotal, but anyone who's ever been to Hoover Dam and you sit there and you see like Mead, and you see the water rushing through, and then they tell you about how much power is generated and how that goes to power all of the bleeping and chirping of the slot machines throughout Las Vegas. And there is a point where you say to yourself, okay, is that more important than, I don't know, alfalfa and people eating and having drinking water? And it's so I think it's striking to see that. Terry?
I think your observation is interesting. I think if you want to really get a close up look at the power of corporate America, just look at this water issue. It also is, I think, is symbolic of what's going on in our country right now in terms of a federal government that really can't seem to solve any problem, whether it's the debt ceiling or water crisis. If you look at those lakes, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, and the Colorado River, if you look at how low they are right now, and if you've been following the news of how much water they've been losing over the last decade, it's alarming. It was alarming 20 years ago. It was alarming 5 years ago. You can literally see where boats used to be able to go out and float on these lakes, and no longer, a boat literally can't get out in the lake anymore because the water is so low. And yet, this is the best they can come up with. And Las Vegas is going to continue to operate and take all that water. It's not a good sign for our democracy if we can't figure out how to actually supply half of our country with clean drinking water.
Dorsey?
And I would agree with that. The article mentioned the negotiations over the Colorado River were spurred by a crisis, and that is consistent with what we've talked about this morning, as you mentioned, Terry, with the debt ceiling. Everything, in order for people to act, it has to be spurred by crisis, and that is not how we should be governing as a nation. We should be more proactive and focus on prevention, and we're not doing that. We have a leadership structure that focuses on living in the now, making decisions based on what's in front of them right now. And as a result, we're not even conscious of our children's future, our children and their children, and which is very unfortunate. There are some who say they are anti-government intervention. However, in this case, it required government intervention to step in to provide a carrot for people to be more conscious about water consumption. Right. And so while states argue for so much autonomy, we have a classic example here in which the government has to intervene so that people have drinking water. So I agree with you. We need a radical shift in decision making here.
Unfortunately, we were out of time. No. We could discuss this more. I know, JP. That's all right. We'll do it again, I promise.
Shall water be 2 hours?
My thanks. thank you so much for being with us. Dorsey Appleers, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and JP Miller. We'll be back right after this.